Hi, I'm Rana Sarkar, and you're listening to Confluence. In each episode, we dive deep into the issue shaping technology, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lens of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. In today's episode, I'm joined by Chris Miller, Associate Professor of International History at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Chris's most recent book, Chip War, The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology, has been getting much deserved media attention and critical acclaim. Chip War is an epic account of the battle to control what is today one of the world's most critical resources, microchip technology, with the United States and China increasingly in conflict. These technologies are foundational, undergirding the Cambrian explosion of all the other technology races we find ourselves within. We're in the midst of a global reordering of industrial and security strategies around the modalities of this conflict. And these are big, multi-billion dollar decisions with lots at stake. States are stepping up by providing billions of dollars of incentives like those in the U.S. Chips and Sciences Act, which is prompting a response from competitors and partners. And these decisions are happening right now, and so there's no better time for this conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed Chris's work, which breaks down the current conflict and puts it into historical context. So I was delighted to sit down with him to gain additional insights on how the semiconductor became the fulcrum of geopolitical and geoeconomic competition, and what lessons from history can be applied today and into the future. Let's jump in.
All right, well, thank you, Chris, for being with us. Your book has received many accolades since it's come out. It is amongst my most gifted books. It's clearly hit on a real vein of interest right now, just given the geopolitical and geoeconomic interest. But I was wondering if you could give, for those just joining, a one-minute summary or so of sort of the core key arguments that you're putting forward in the book.
The book argues that semiconductors are really a key to understanding power in the modern world, both computing power, which exists only thanks to lots and lots of silicon chips inside of all of our devices, but also economic power and increasingly geopolitical and military power, because militaries are just as dependent on semiconductors and the computing capabilities that they enable as the rest of the economy. And as we see more and more tension in East Asia between the U.S., Japan, China, other countries jockeying for military position, we see them also turning to try to control the supply chains that produce the computing power that will define the next generation of defense systems. And so semiconductors are a device that most political leaders didn't think much about 10 years ago, but now are at the center of political discussion precisely because of their strategic importance.
I want to dig into that point about that most people missed. And in your book, you argue, of course, that China spends more importing chips than it does oil. Just the sheer facts that you put out, I think you make a pretty strong case for the idea that chips are the sort of the oil of this century that we're in. But how did we miss that? And we meaning, I think that as everyone else was occupied by other resource challenges or contests in the world, and we were looking at other spaces of diplomacy and of confrontation. How did we miss this incredibly important sort of undergirding layer of the geopolitical order?
Well, I think for a long time, policymakers thought about tech as being about software and internet companies, about social media, about search engines, rather than digging into the components that made computing possible. And for a long time, that was an easy assumption to make and a costless assumption, because the key components were produced by countries that we were collectively quite comfortable buying from. The Netherlands or Japan were not seen as unreliable suppliers by any means. But the key shift that's happened over the past decade is that, first off, Taiwan's central role in the chip industry has grown every single year, to the point that today Taiwan produces 90% of the world's most advanced processor chips and over one-third of the new computing power the world adds each year. So it's critically important to the world economy. And at the same time as its importance has grown, China's military power in the Taiwan Straits has grown too. And so the the risk involved of concentration of chip making capacity on that island is much higher than it would have been a decade ago. And although both of those trends were foreseeable in some ways from the perspective of, say, 2010, very few people put them together. In large part, I think, because the number of people who simultaneously understood the operation of semiconductor supply chains and also thought about the military balance was a very, very small set of people. And so from the highest level of governments in the US, in Europe, and in other in Japan and other areas, this shift went on largely unnoticed until the middle of the last decade.
If you were to handicap the current state of the chip conflict right now, and we, of course, had the Chips and Science Act, the move for reshoring and resilient supply chain for chips, which is, as many observers would note, is easier said than done, given not just the absolute dominance of Taiwan and TSMC in the advanced chip manufacturing, and how long it takes to build a fab, and how long it it takes to put the supply chains and talent resources in place to do that. And of course, there have been significant commitments made in Arizona, for instance, with Intel and TSMC as well. But even if we're just speaking about those most advanced chips, like it's going to take a while. So how do you see this this next 36 or 48 or maybe 72 months playing out in this contest?
Well, I think you're absolutely right to suggest this is a long-term contest for the reasons that you articulated. I think there are two separate but interrelated problems that policymakers are simultaneously trying to solve. One is the question of security of supply as Chinese military capabilities vis-a-vis Taiwan grow. And the second challenge is making sure that we collectively, countries that see the world in a similar way, have an advantage over their adversaries in technological and therefore in military terms. And those challenges are interrelated because some of the key companies that are involved in both of those processes are the same, but they're somewhat distinct. And so I think in terms of the, can we guarantee that we have resilience in the case of a Chinese attack or blockade on Taiwan, I think the answer is we're going to be making important strides over the next couple of years, but we're still going to be very reliant on chips made in Taiwan in 5 years' time, and I think likely in 10 years' time as well. The reality is that Taiwanese chips are in almost everything, and building up the capacity needed to shift these supply chains is just going to take a very long time. So yes, we're making progress on that front, but it's going to be long and partial progress relative to what I think we wish we had on them. The second question of making sure that we're staying ahead of potential adversaries, I think here too, we've got a lot of work to be done. The reality is that if you look at China, which is the most important and challenging question here, the Chinese tech ecosystem has made substantial advances in many different subsegments over the past decade. There's a vast domestic market they can sell to. And although the government in China has proven to be a pretty mediocre tech investor, they've got a well-developed venture capital scene and tech firms that have proven quite capable of developing many types of new technology. So I think China will be a formidable challenger. The West in aggregate has some real advantages still over China, but that's no reason for complacency, because I think the extent to which China has closed the gap between its cutting edge and the cutting edge produced by Western countries has surprised most observers over the last decade. And so we should not be complacent about where China's cutting edge will be in one decade's time.
Keeping this context in mind, I asked Chris to elaborate on China's policies to support the development of its domestic chip fabrication capacity. What challenges does China face as it tries to catch up to the Western semiconductor industry?
Of course, the chip industry is a much more vast industry than the top end of these chips, but the top end is where the geopolitical contest is really the sharpest. But maybe you could just describe the catch-up in this Manhattan Project of chip design and chip fabrication that China's in the midst of. And maybe just maybe take a stab at that question is it possible? Are we foreseeing this? Is this type of a policy a two-year, three-year forestall or is it something which is a much more endurable edge that allied folks would have over China if they were to proceed along the current paths as it's set out?
Well, the key to answering that question, I think, is to remember that the chip industry operates quite differently than most other segments of the economy, because the rate of improvement in the chip industry has historically followed the prediction made by Gordon Moore called Moore's Law, which predicts a doubling of processing power every couple of years. And what that means is that there's exponential growth built into the chip industry, which makes it the hardest of any industry across the economy to catch up in, because it's not a matter of getting to today's technology. It's a matter of catching up to the cutting edge, which is racing forward at exponential rates of improvement. And so that makes catch up really extraordinarily difficult. There's only a couple of examples in the history of the industry of countries catching up that had started out far behind. And when you look at where China stands today, that's the biggest issue that China faces. It's had no difficulty. Chinese firms have had no difficulty acquiring decades-old technology. But a decade-old technology is so far behind the cutting edge today that it's almost irrelevant for most use cases. And so if you look at the types of inputs you need to make a cutting-edge chip, ultra-specialized software tools, some of the most complex machine tools humans have ever made, really specialized and purified chemicals, fabrication capacity that rise on a lot of really unique types of knowledge across that supply chain, Chinese firms remain behind the cutting edge and in some cases far behind the cutting edge. So it'll be quite difficult for China to domesticate most or all of this supply chain and produce cutting edge chips without access to Western technology. And increasingly they're finding, because of regulatory decisions made in Washington and in Tokyo and some European countries, that access to the most advanced tools is increasingly cut off for Chinese firms.
I think that, you know, that answer gets at the heart of, you know, the debate in industrial policy worlds right now, where the conversation is, and it really leads on to a point that you raised in your book, which was in the past there was a copy it strategy. If you know, using either chips that were acquired through sort of trade or license or even subterfuge, there was an opportunity to sort of copy a prior technology. What you're suggesting is that the ecosystem that's required to get to the most beyond the cutting edge requires a sort of an advanced and deep ecosystem of partners. And where China has in the past, and you know, Chinese and industrial scholars and others would say that the, you know, from examples of the Shenzhen region, you know, recent examples of other forms of cooperative of work within industries where you get that kind of cross-fertilization effect amongst players. I mean, China may be the best, most recent example of how industrialization could work on that scale. But are we suggesting that that's not easily said and done in the chip industry because of the global nature of this? And you know, you've got companies like ASML in the Netherlands that produces, you know, one piece of equipment which is ultra essential for, you know, some of these more advanced chips, including the 5 and the 3 nanometer chips. How would you sort of take on a question like that?
Well, you know, I think in a lot of industries, we have seen Chinese firms catch up technologically, but it's also worth noting a lot we haven't. And especially when it comes to advanced manufacturing, aerospace is another example of an industry where Chinese firms have really struggled to master the combination of precision engineering and managing a complex supply chain. You might expect that, particularly given the military importance of aviation, China would have made greater strides than it has today in terms of catch up. In cloud computing, Chinese cloud computing firms only have domestic market share in many parts of the tech sector. Chinese firms have succeeded mostly in the domestic market and less so in export markets. There are exceptions to that, but that's the general rule. And so I think the first step is to actually look critically at where China has caught up and where it hasn't. And what you find is that although there's very impressive catch up, it's much more of a nuanced picture than I think our sort of popular perceptions would indicate. I think next to that, the chip industry does have some unique aspects in just the ultra specialization of the knowledge involved. Because for multiple key components of the production process, there's nanometer level precision required using capabilities that are really only housed and developed in a couple of firms. And in industries like this, where you can't go to school and study the relevant disciplines because the disciplines themselves are built up in these handful of firms, acquiring the level of tacit knowledge needed to produce competitive products is just a really, really difficult, difficult challenge. And so when it comes to the machine tools in particular, that has given those companies a pretty deep competitive moat, and made it such that, they don't really have plausible Chinese competitors today. They, over time, I think Chinese firms will begin to make inroads into this market, but it'll be a very long process. And my very strong bet would be that in 10 years' time, the leading firms that in that subsector of the chip industry will still be firms based in Japan, the US, and Europe.
Chris and I then turned to the development of quantum computing, an emerging technology that potentially has significant implications for the semiconductor industry.
It's interesting. I mean, last week here in San Francisco, I hosted a fairly substantial quantum delegation as part of a Photonics West show here, 20,000 people. All of the, you know, sort of leading edges of quantum were in San Francisco. And then a few interesting sort of outcomes from that. One was that a fairly widespread belief that, you know, if Moore's law is to continue, just given the physical properties of chips, as we know it, material sciences as we know it, quantum is going to play a significant role in that. And so it's, you know, we're not talking in bits, we're going to be talking in qubits. And so, and China has obviously made quantum computing a significant investment area. And you know, I and some would say that that they have a more parity in the quantum area than in others. And so how would you, if you overlay this new area of competition, which is getting at the heart of what, you know, chips do and their geopolitical importance, into this conversation?
I think the challenge with assessing the impact of quantum computing comes in that we don't know when quantum computing will first become practically relevant. It's obviously a fascinating area of research and development right now, but we don't know when the first practical application will be. And I think that the history of classical computing shows that although technologies can be revolutionary, their spread across society happens slower than the revolutionary nature might suggest. And if you think of the amount of time it took from the invention of the first semiconductor to the iPhone, that was a generation of people that brought that across. And that's not to sound pessimistic, but just to say it takes time to understand how we use new technologies in interesting ways and pair them together and produce marketable products. So my sense with quantum computing is that from the first commercially or practically relevant use, there will be a several decades long process of testing different use cases across society and finding out where it's useful, where it's less useful, how it can be paired with existing capabilities to produce more products. And the net takeaway of that for me is that I think we're going to be living in a world that'll be dominated primarily by classical computing for the foreseeable future, which isn't, and that's not a pessimistic case about quantum, but it's just to say that the embeddedness of semiconductors for classical computing in our economy, in our machines, in our society is such that displacing it will just be a long process. And so as a result, I would be skeptical of a thesis that says quantum will revolutionize society, even though I completely believe it's going to revolutionize certain use cases on day one. And even though I also completely believe it will have a really profound effect over a longer time horizon.
From here, we dig deeper into the geopolitics of the semiconductor industry, considering the different types of chips being produced today, and considering how trade and industrial policies may evolve over the next 5 years.
Say something, if you could, about the way in which chip technology, not just at the higher end, but also for more industrial uses, is starting to play out as a geopolitical issue. And obviously, you know, in automotive, we saw it in the last 18 months, chip shortages in vehicles, but we're seeing it increasingly across the a number of different value chains. And our, now as countries start to think about chips as central to their own industrial policy and trade policies, how do you see the world evolve in chips over the course of the next 5 years, say?
Well, I think when it comes to the types of chips that are not at the leading edge, I think you're right to suggest that they're in some ways just as important. If you look at the share of GDP produced by lagging edge versus leading edge chips, you find that it's lagging edge chips that are more important for the broader economy because cars and dishwashers and microwaves all require them, even though they don't often require leading edge chips. So you don't want a shortage in either one, but it would be wrong to underestimate, you know, the lagging edge chips. And that's true as well in a security sense too. It's on the one hand, it's the leading edge chips that are largely in data centers or in the application processors for smartphones or PCs, but it's mostly lagging edge chips that are connecting together the Internet of Things. It's mostly lagging edge chips that are operating vehicles and transportation networks. And so as you think about cybersecurity risks and hardware security risks across economies and societies, you need to think far beyond just the single chip that is running your operating system in your iPhone. You need to think about all of the chips that are networking together, all the devices that require computing power and are attached to each other and to the internet. And that's a question for the lagging edge. And that's relevant both in terms of making sure we have sufficient supply and resilience of supply in case of crisis, but also in terms of thinking about security. Because we need confidence that the chips that are providing this networked economy, bringing together all sorts of different devices, are themselves secure. And so that's, I think, going to be a growing focus of discussion is making sure we've got guarantees that the chips that we're using are operating in the ways that they were intended to operate and that they were designed in ways that we can understand and can trust.
Before we wrap up our conversation, I asked Chris to share views on the role of Canada and the potential for a secure, resilient North American semiconductor supply chain.
What advice would you give to me and my colleagues, Canadian policymakers, and people involved in, you know, the North America discussion about resilient supply chains, about what the next secure North America looks like? And where do chips fall into this? And, you know, some may argue that, you know, it's sort of like the automotive industry or aspects of the energy industry in ages past, where if you don't have some component of that that manufacturing happening domestically, then you are at a disadvantage in the longer run. And how do you see this between, you know, countries looking at it from a sort of a national self-interest perspective and also putting together these allyships that are going to be required in a divided world?
You know, I think it's right to suggest that there are strategic benefits that accrue to countries that have positions in the semiconductor supply chain. I think that doesn't mean that every country needs to race towards trying to acquire the most advanced manufacturing capabilities, because as we discussed, the supply chain is complex, it's long, there's very high-tech production at different parts of the supply chain and very high value-added production at different parts of the supply chain. And so, you know, Canada, as an example, has very impressive chip design capabilities, a cluster particularly around Toronto that is world-class by many metrics. And so I think it would be wrong to have all governments around the world focusing on fabrication, focusing on manufacturing at the expense of the rest of the supply chain, which is equally important, often equally profitable, and equally technologically complex. And so when I look at the North American ecosystem, for example, it seems to me that there's going to be plenty of scope for differentiated responsibilities among different players, sort of like what we have in the auto industry, where we've got supply chains that very efficiently cross borders. And that's something we ought to welcome, because no country is going to go it alone on semiconductors. And so we need to find mechanisms where countries that can trade with each other in a trusted manner can have efficient supply chains that are uninterrupted by regulatory barriers or by politics.
you know, you've been on this journey of writing about chips, just as it's a, you know, the chip conversation has become extremely hot, and I'm sure you've been pulled into a lot of very interesting rooms. And what has surprised you the most, and have you changed your view or sharpened your view, you know, since you've written the book, based on conversations or events that you've seen?
You know, I think I would flag two things that have my views have changed on over the last year or so. And the first is the extent to which many governments have gone from a position of not thinking hard about semiconductors to thinking hard and creatively and intelligently about them in a relatively short period of time. And so I give a number of governments, including the U.S. government, pretty high marks for rapidly coming to terms with what the issue is and why it matters. So that would be one thing. I think a second thing is thinking about semiconductors in the context of the technologies in which they're being used. Because of course, chips are a component, but components are relevant because they work in systems. And right now, chip companies are increasingly thinking about how can we get performance gains out of not only designing and manufacturing the best chips, but designing them and manufacturing them so that they work the best in the systems that they're intended for. And so being creative and thinking across supply chains all the way down to the end user and understanding how production processes and design fits into the end user's ultimately use case is going to be critical to keeping Moore's Law alive, but is also, I think, critical for policymakers, because semiconductor production is great, but we produce semiconductors to have other manufactured goods. And so making sure we're drawing the connections between the computers and smartphones and cars that chips are going into is just as critical as making sure we have chip production in the abstract.
I do hope that we could see you in Canada at some stage and to have you up and properly go over some of these issues that that we've raised here amongst my colleagues, particularly in the technology diplomacy space. There's obviously a lot of interest in this subgenre, and it is receiving way more attention than folks even a few years ago would have expected. But I think all for the better. So, thank you so much for joining us today and on Confluence.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Confluence. I hope you're able to walk away from today's episode with some fresh perspectives. Additional resources are available in the episode show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Chris Miller for being my guest. Production thanks to Marie Olnick, Kate Walter, Augustus Clark, Steph Colburn, Kathleen Speckert, and Olivia Richardson. I'm Rana Sarkar, and thank you for listening. Until next time.